Does picking an outfit have you running a little too fashionably late? We get it. Great taste takes time. That's why Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery, has your back with the largest selection of beer, wine, and spirits delivered in under 60 minutes. Convenience never goes out of style. So if you need to spend some extra time in the mirror instead of at the store, download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com today.
Did you know Nissan EVs have traveled 8 billion miles? Just a quick trip to Pluto and back. And what did we learn along the way? Well, that an EV can take on the world, like the Nissan Leaf. It can move racing forward and take your breath away, like the all-new Nissan Ariya. We learned to make EVs that electrify. 8 billion miles driven by Leaf owners globally since 2010. Ariya not yet available for purchase. Expected availability late fall, subject to change.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens, hosted by Nate Wilcox. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, Ed Ward returns to begin a series of discussions on the second volume of his History of Rock and Roll. This episode focuses on the British invasion and rise of Motown in 1964 and America's folk rock and soul music responses in 1965. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to let it roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox, and once again, the prodigal son has returned. Ed Ward, the original co-host of the show, is back with the History of Rock and Roll, Volume 2, 1964 to 1973, for our purposes, although the title says 1977. Ed, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Good. And so, do you want to explain the 1977 thing up front, or dive right in?
Well, this will be corrected in 2 years when they do the paperback. I couldn't convince the editor to change that title. I really do. Is this thing goes up to essentially the last waltz, which I believe is 1974, the end of the band. But earlier in the book, I have talked about the Elvis 1968 comeback special, his Christmas TV show, which was an unprecedented thing in popular music. Never before had a faded star come roaring back and become hugely popular once again. And I ended that chapter by saying, who would have guessed, looking at how young and vital he looked, that he would be dead before 10 years was up. And then I realized as I was writing on, you dropped that there, you've got to pick it up. So I wrote a chapter about Elvis's death in 1977 as an addendum, and I marked it as such, but the editor didn't seem to understand that there was a whole lot more between where the main narrative left off and this one little ending. It's nice to put it there because it is the end of Elvis, the end of an era, and very definitely seals off a moment of rock and roll history. But unfortunately, I haven't yet been slammed by the type of critic who likes to do that sort of thing. But
Yeah, that's not a big deal, but I wanted to give you a chance to clarify that. And I think the band actually, the last waltz concert was November 1976. So you can make a case that it goes up to 77. And you know, one of the things I like to do when I read this is wait for you to miss something. And every time I think I've got you, there's the paragraph mentioning Queen, or, I thought I had you on not bringing up Land of the Rising Sun, House of the Rising Sun by the Animals in this first chapter we're going to discuss today. And it's there. I found it. So you know, you're a slippery one, Ed. You're a slippery one. I can't. So, but let's start with the purpose of the book. In the introduction, you say that the purpose of the book is to show how movements arise, how they interact with their intended audiences, and how they die. What's that mean?
Yeah, that, well, it means that rock and roll, having become the pretty much default way of expressing popular music, it then tribalized. You know, there were people, well, to begin with, there were Beatles people and Stones people and none of those people. But now, as it goes into the 60s and 70s, there are genres within rock and roll. And that their adherents are come out of scenes. You know, there's this New York scene. There's well, that's getting ahead of me. I was going to say the Austin scene. And there was a California scene, definitely. And there was a scene up in the Pacific Northwest. And these all had their distinctive modes of clothing, speaking, words. And in some of them, there were also scenes that went beyond music. There were painters and writers and artists of various sorts that were all working alongside of the musicians. They might meet when the musicians played or in a club that the musicians were favored in. But it was a much larger thing than just, you know, a bunch of guys with guitars.
And you title the first chapter, "Your Sons and Daughters Are Beyond Your Command." A Bob Dylan quote from his song, "The Times They Are Changing," in which you discuss in the chapter. Why did you pick that quote for this chapter?
Oh, probably because I'd just been to see Bill Kirchen performing. Bill has a remarkable version of that song in his set that shows that it's completely contemporary. But the another reason is the song is taking note of something pretty much after it's happened. Teenagers are now their own society. Even if they're living with their parents still, they are moving away from being obedient little kids. This was heightened by rock and roll. There were kids who listened to, admittedly, people who were older than they are, making music that said, you know, the old rules don't apply.
And now they're about to start hearing music made by people increasingly close to their own age, starting with the Beatles. You start the chapter with a date, December 26, 1963. What happened on that date? It's the day that the DJ plays "I Want to Hold Your Hand" in WWDCAM.
Yeah. Okay, that was interesting. There was a disc jockey in Washington, D.C., who had a friend who was a flight attendant on the British Overseas Airways Corporation, as it was known in those days. And she came into Washington with a copy of the Beatles single, "I Want to Hold Your Hand," and gave it to this guy and said, you know, you might want to play this on your radio show. And he did, and it basically ignited Beatlemania. The folks at Capitol Records who had been not real crazy about putting out a record by four guitar-wielding guys from Liverpool thought, maybe this will work. And, of course, the fans went, what was that?
And the explosion was on. And because Capitol had turned down the single, the previous singles, two American small labels, Swan, had gotten the rights to "She Loves You" and had not been able to make it hit. And VJ had put out "Please Please Me" and then passed on "She Loves You." And so as soon as this hits, VJ, you know, Capitol goes to the record presses. You mentioned that RCA, they actually had to borrow RCA's pressing plants to print up enough copies of I Want to Hold Your Hand. They print up a million copies of the thing, and 200,000 of those were farmed out to RCA. But VJ and Swan immediately get back in the act and re-release their Beatles licensed tracks, and the lawsuits are flying.
So, yeah, all of a sudden there were more Beatle records than you could keep track of. There's also a label called Tolly that had a Beatles record. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was. But
I guess it would be Let Me Do.
VJ had to move so fast that they misspelled the word Beatles on the first pressings of their Beatles record. And also, it played a heavy part in putting them out of business. This veteran blues and soul label sold so many records that they went out of business, which seems to be paradoxical until you understand the way credit works in the record business.
Yeah, I mean, they get in hock for all the records that they print, and then they can't collect from the distributors in time to pay their bills. And if they don't have another Beatles album coming, the distributors don't feel any inclination to pay. So it's a story we discussed in the first part of rock history, and it's something that's going to continue to happen to smaller labels throughout the rest of the 20th century. But the Beatles just explode, and I think that your point about this depth of catalog suddenly becoming available was a big factor in just how big they got, because it wasn't a matter of here's one enormous hit single with no catalog behind it. Suddenly there's an enormous hit single, and there's another enormous hit single, and a third one, and there's a whole album of Beatles stuff. And if you really dig, there's two albums of Beatles stuff. And so kids were just flooded with Beatles product, and it was all great.
And they were all buying it. There was a record store that reported to Billboard about how little kids would come into the store, ask for a Beatles record, and not even look at anything else. They'd pay for their Beatles record and leave. That was all they were interested in.
But it did have some spillover effect. And, you know, that same Ed Sullivan that they debuted on, actually, it's time for me to play our first song, which is the very first Beatles song played on American national television. This is the Beatles doing All My Loving on the Ed Sullivan Show, February 1964.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be true. And then while I'm away, I'll write home every day. And I'll send all my loving to you.
And that was the Beatles doing Paul McCartney's All My Loving on the Ed Sullivan Show in February. And I think one thing that's important to stress for audiences in 2019 or 2020 when this drops, that this TV show was enormous on a level we cannot comprehend today. Something like 70 million plus people watched this. Can you describe the impact of, you know, three broadcast channels, Ed Sullivan, Sunday Night, the highest rated show on TV, even without the Beatles? You add the Beatles in this wave of hype. I mean, what was that like? Was that just dominating conversation everywhere across the country all at once the next day?
Well, among a certain demographic, yes, but certainly not among adults. This was obviously not to be taken seriously.
But it was still a big enough phenomenon that adults had to discuss it. I mean, they had the Beatle wigs, and virtually every corny TV sitcom in 1964 did some kind of Beatles parody.
Yeah.
You know, everybody was aware of it. It was just that the kids were the ones who loved it.
Everybody was aware of it. Not many people were in favor of it, maybe is the way to put it. And there was also the fact that the entire northeast of the country was snowed in at the point where the evening of the Ed Sullivan Show, and nobody was going out. So, oh, gee, we got to stay home. What are we going to do? Well, watch Ed Sullivan, of course. And so they did.
And right there on that same episode is the Dave Clark Five, a Tottenham band from North London, that immediately the term, you know, as you're talking about, it takes a little while for the term British invasion to start getting thrown out there. But immediately the record industry, not every company can get a piece of the Beatles, even though several have. But Epic's got the Dave Clark 5 out. Somebody else signs Jerry and the Pacemakers. I mean, the Mercy Beat explosion comes to America pretty quickly on the heels of the Beatles.
And flopped for the most part, because not all of the talent in Liverpool was all that good. And, you know, I mean, who listens to the Undertakers these days?
Yeah, you know, I scraped that one up. It's not worth the trouble.
I mean, that may have been Jackie Lomax's band, and he may have been a good friend of George Harrison's, but just because they were from Liverpool, what really should have happened should have been that American A&R people should have looked more closely at England, because there were, you know, there were things going on in Liverpool's arch rival Manchester, and up the coast a bit in I forgot it, where the animal
Newcastle
was from.
On Tyne. Newcastle on Tyne.
Yeah.
It's on the opposite.
And there were all kinds of bands all over the place, most of whom formed when they saw the Beatles, when the Beatles were doing their fairly intense touring of the British Isles. It was just, it was an inspiration. And some of those people did have talent, as we eventually got to find out.
And even the lesser talented ones, I mean, the Dave Clark Five did incredibly well in the States and managed to keep the Mercy Beat alive long after the Beatles had dropped it, because probably because Dave Clark couldn't play any other rhythms. But you talk about George Harrison's famous quote, you know, what do they've got everything here when he came to the States. What do they need us for? And what the States had going was the folk scene. Give us a little update on what the folk scene was doing in early 64.
Well, it was trying to establish itself. And part of what people were, what the record industry was after was not solo performers, but what I call hootenanny bands, you know, where the sort of expanded versions of the Kingston Trio with several singers and a lot of guitars and banjos and upright bass and, you know, basically acoustic bands, the Noblick Upper 10,000 and so forth. And even some of the band leaders who had big bands that played society events had hootenanny bands. That's where David Crosby came from. He was playing in, I believe, Les Brown's or somebody had a hootenanny band.
Yeah, it was the Les Brown Orchestra.
Yeah, and, you know, which they might have hauled these kids around as a in-between sets entertainment. Well, the band's going to take a break now, but we'd like to present some talented youngsters, yada, yada. And there was David.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to the way Lonnie Donegan's Skiffle Band emerged out of the trad jazz, the bigger trad jazz bands in England about 7 years earlier. But you also had these really popular Joan Baez and Kingston Trio that were moving enormous amounts of LPs.
Paul and Mary, they're the ones to look at, because they were managed by Albert Grossman, who was a guy who used to own a folk club in Chicago, but decided to go full-fledged into management and started signing up people. He got Peter, Paul, and Mary, and through them, he got Bob Dylan.
Yeah, and he used Peter, Paul, and Mary to promote Bob Dylan, because they're the ones who covered Dylan's songs and brought him to the pop charts first. But Dylan's had his sort of underground breakthrough with the Free Will and Bob Dylan, his second album. And we talked about that in the 1963 episodes, but now he comes out with The Times They Are a Changin', and it's a very different thing. It's much more political. He participates in the March on Washington and acquires a pretty heavy reputation as a voice of his generation, a label that he would try to get away from.
He doesn't try to get away. If you've been to see him recently, MC always goes, and now, ladies and gentlemen, the man you've been coming, you've been waiting to see, the a great songwriter and the voice of his generation. They say that every night.
So I tried to get away from
it. Bob has to be okay with that.
Yeah, maybe winning the Nobel Prize changed his mind on that. But another songwriter that was
before that happened.
Yeah, I mean he's. And then, but another songwriter who is making political statements, although more guardedly, and having more success on the pop charts at this point, is Chicago's Curtis Mayfield and his band The Impressions.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. They it was the civil rights movement, and Curtis came out of the church, and there was a branch of the black church that was progressive. Largely centered apparently in Chicago, because that's also where Pop Staples was doing his thing. And Pop Staples kept it in the church, but Curtis had already gone pop. And he was really big on making political statements, that gentle political statements. You know, he was not, you know, writing songs called Kill Whitey or anything, or Integration Now. He was saying, you know, be proud of yourself, keep pushing, keep moving. This is all going to turn out okay.
And let's hear a little bit of. Go ahead and finish your point, and then we'll hear. Keep on pushing.
Sometimes he couched it in the language of the church. Sometimes he just flat out, like Bob Dylan, wrote a protest song. You hear People Get Ready is definitely in the language of the church. You know, this train he's talking about, is it about salvation, or is it more a salvation on an earthly level, meaning justice to black people? That's one of the great things that Curtis Mayfield was able to do.
And let's hear The Impressions, Keep On Pushing.
Keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength.
And that was Curtis Mayfield in The Impressions with Keep On Pushing. And another soul singer who started to dabble with political statements right at the end of his life was Sam Cooke.
Once again, the church in Chicago.
And his song A Change Is Gonna Come was the B-side of his last hit single, Shake, which was a cutting-edge dance tune. And we talked about Sam a lot in the 1963 episode, but I think it's definitely worth mentioning him again in 1964, because he was absolutely at the top of the music business world. He'd gotten control of his publishing. He had his own record company. He was still having hits, and he was taking, you know, the Shake, Change Is Gonna Come single. It is just absolutely a signpost for where the 60s are gonna go. He'd been listening to Sly Stone's first production on Bobby Freeman's Do the Swim, and he incorporates, you know, the absolute cutting edge of R&B dance into the Shake, and then he's listening to Bob Dylan and produces A Change Is Gonna Come. So we don't get into hypothetical histories here, but definitely if Sam had lived, he would have continued making a huge impact, but he didn't.
Oh yeah.
And so go ahead.
No, go ahead, you too.
Well, I was just gonna say, you know, in the vacuum left by Sam Cooke's death, Berry Gordy's Motown does more than step into the breach. I mean, they blow it wide open. And in the summer of 64, the Supremes start an unprecedented run of number one hit singles.
But Berry stayed far, far away from politics. It was, he felt that would alienate the large white audience that he'd attracted, and he'd done that on purpose.
Yes, and it was probably a shrewd decision. And you know, plenty of other people stepped into the breach there. And the rest of R&B does its best to keep up with Motown. Atlantic is, it's kind of the last gasp of the Brill building, or Teen Pan Alley, where Atlantic has hits with the Drifters Under the Boardwalk and Solomon Burke has hits. But how did that coterie of songwriters, the Gary Goffins and Carole Kings, deal with the British invasion?
Not well. Goffin and King were writing songs for the Animals and for Paul Revere and the Raiders, who were an American, British-flavored group from the Pacific Northwest. And also the Birds, strangely enough. But a lot of those people couldn't hear Dylan. You know, Dylan wasn't boy-girl subjects. The level of abstraction in his lyrics was something they thought was horrible. You know, they couldn't stand listening to it. And so a lot of those people, they didn't make the transition. Some of them did. Goffin and King, Carole King obviously went on to a career as a solo artist. And in another songwriting factory on the West Coast, Randy Newman was writing stuff, not for the Animals, but for Alan Price when he left the Animals. There's the first album by Alan Price, the Alan Price Set, has a bunch of Randy Newman songs that nobody has heard. I mean, they are on his albums.
And Burt Burns, the producer of and writer of Twist and Shout, he actually went to England and discovered Van Morrison and produced his first few hits.
Well, Them was doing very well in Britain, and they were doing okay in the United States. But Burt's genius was in discovering that the rest of them were just, you know, them. And then there was this other guy standing in front, this little guy played saxophone, and he was what was worth looking at and developing. So he brought him to the United States and did so.
And recorded him in England too, with Jimmy Page making a big mark on those early Them records as well, and becoming a protege of Burt Burns. And the Beatles have a second act immediately in the summer when their movie A Hard Day's Night comes out. And you explain a little bit about what that movie added to the Beatle fan experience.
Well, it was a chance to see your favorite Beatle blown up to gigantic size on the screen in a movie theater. And it was your chance to experience the Beatles with perfectly mixed sound, and you see them playing. And it also gave you the opportunity to be in the middle of the screaming crowds that followed the Beatles everywhere, or so the film would have us believe. I think they were probably a little better protected, not having to run down train station platforms pursued by screaming girls. But, you know, it was a way of saying, you're right, you've made the right decision. Here are the Beatles. Here is as much of the Beatles as we can cram into an hour and a half.
And that movie, go ahead.
You know, people went to see that movie over and over. That it was like playing a record, you know. Audiences just loved it.
And it captured a real sense of sort of high water of modernism and the black and white footage. It's artsy and creative, and Richard Lester's direction is innovative, and it's sort of the high watermark of the early 60s idea of hip, even though the Beatles themselves would morph into more of a hippie sort of hip within just 18 months from making A Hard Day's Night. There's a moment that's crystallized in Hard Day's Night that's very much the state of the art of 1964. And people like Roger Miller on the country pop side were having hits like King of the Road. And the Smothers Brothers sort of to me epitomized that, even though they continued to be popular in the later 60s. But that sort of short-haired Bob Newhart smartass kind of guy who's looking at the world in a winking way, but not really challenging the sort of Rat Pack older generation dominance at that point. And you know, Roger Miller to me is really fascinating because he's this classic Nashville singer-songwriter who's retrospectively, King of the Road just totally overwhelms the rest of his work. But if you start chronologically and listen to Roger Miller, he's got a ton of really fun songs, Dang Me and Chug-a-Lug and all these other things. And
but there's something about, heard.
Yeah. And there's something about Roger Miller that, you know, peaks at this period and he never quite captures that form again. I think it's, you know, this it's a fulcrum, 1964, the end of the old era and the beginning of the other. And it's very unique in the Beatles' accomplishment that they're able to personify what was cool in 1964 and yet be in a position to keep evolving as the 60s, as the changes in the 60s accelerate. And another go ahead.
Soon they had to do with their youth and the fact that, you know, creativity, once you hook into a way of doing it, doing something expressive, it can, if you know, it's like a plant. If you continue to water it and feed it, you know, it'll get bigger.
And another document in 1964 that it sort of captures this high point of rock and roll, because, you know, this is kind of the last year when artists like Chuck Berry have hits, when Jerry Lee Lewis is still able to tour England and draws a very similar crowd to the Beatles and the Stones. You know, Little Richard and the Everly Brothers are touring England around this time as well. And the some enterprising entrepreneurs on the West Coast put together something called the Tammy Show and managed to book this incredible lineup of bands. You've got the Beach Boys, you've got several Motown acts, you've got Jerry and the Pacemakers, you've got the Rolling Stones, you've got James Brown, and it all fits together beautifully. What was going on in 1964 that allowed such diversity, not just diversity between American bands and British bands, but African-American groups are fitting in seamlessly in this pop explosion?
Well, there's a bunch of things about the Tammy Show. For one thing, you can't really see them unless you're looking for them, but the band that plays on that film was amazing. It had Leon Russell, it had Glenn Campbell, it had a whole bunch of famous names who became famous later, you know, as, you know, the Wrecking Crew and other such backing groups. And but the thing is that, see, nobody knew what the kids were interested in, you know, because they weren't kids. Their kiddom was far enough behind them and utterly unlike what was going on right now, that they just figured, well, you know, stuff that's on the charts, look on the charts, and, you know, here, we can't get the Beatles, we can't get the Stones, well, maybe we can't get the Stones. Who's this guy, James Brown? You know, they'd go for one act, get turned down, but the agent will go, well, how about this one? And so it wasn't done via, you know, the quote unquote scientific research that you employed for radio playlists and such. It was just put together for the kids, whoever they were, whatever they liked.
And the Rolling Stones, who hadn't broken in America yet, they were big in England by this point. They'd come up in the wake of the Beatles in 63 as sort of London's answer and playing a hard rhythm and blues, a electric blues-based style of rhythm blues that was different than the sort of Ray Charles-derived rhythm and blues that was big in Mercy. But they hadn't broken in the States, but Andrew Lee Goldham, their manager, was really making a point to work the States. And they toured in the summer of 64 when really people in America didn't want to hear about it, the Stones yet. Santa Barbara and New York were ready for them, but they were also playing, you know, to 50 people in Omaha, playing a county fair in San Antonio. And then they had to go on after James Brown. And James had no mercy on them and pulled out all the stops.
But he also appreciated them and gave them free tickets to his next appearance at the Apollo Theater in Harlem.
And it was probably pretty hard for him to resist them, given that Mick Jagger was and Tony Basil, the choreographer and later pop star, were standing there, you know, desperately trying to learn every single dance move James was throwing up. And let's cue up and hear the Stones doing Chuck Berry's Around and Around live on the Tammy Show.
What a crazy sound. Good, they never stopped rocking. Damn, the moon went down. so sweet. I had to take me a chance. I rose out of my seat. Just had to dance. Started moving my feet. Wore the clap of my hands.
And that was the Rolling Stones covering their master Chuck Berry's Around and Around. And that's a performance that, despite, you know, kind of getting blown off stage, and Andrew Oldham in his memoirs talks about how he feigned an equipment breakdown so they would have an extra long break after James Brown before the Stones went on. But people like Patti Smith talk in their, you know, memoirs and about what an impact the Stones performance there. And, you know, it's very anarchic. Keith Richards turns his back on the audience at the beginning of the show. Brian Jones is leaping around. And there's this new, stronger energy coming out of this second wave. I mean, it's just 1 year, but we're already having a second wave of British invasion bands. And you've got the Kinks, who are already reacting to Louie Louie by the Kingsmen, which is this explosion of garage rock that came out of the Northwest, Pacific Northwest of the U.S. in late 63 and continues to be a big hit in 64. And the Kinks assimilate that into You Really Got Me. But something happens that keeps the Kinks from capitalizing on their success in the States.
Well, part of it was that they, all the British bands had trouble getting visas and getting clearances from the Musicians Union. But the Kinks in particular were, as you say, anarchic. They were just crazy, you know, and the two Davies brothers didn't really like each other. So they were constantly fighting on stage. They eventually got denied live performances in the United States because there were so many complaints about them. But they continued to make really great records. They came out of R&B. That's another thing. The first Kinks album is a bunch of covers of R&B, similar to the Stones, but not as well done. And there were so many R&B bands at that point. The Stones came out of an intermission band for another British jazz band, but it got to where the fans came to see them, came to see the intermission band, and walked out on the headliners. And so that's the point when people began to realize there was something going on with the Stones.
Yeah, the Stones were sort of analogous to the folk movement in the States, and that they came out of this trad jazz adjacent scene, or a subset of the trad jazz scene that was into authentic blues, and their mentor Alexis Korner and his Blues Incorporated was one of the groups that you're mentioning that they quickly blew past. But by late 64, they're having hits in the States, and like you mentioned in the book, Time Is On My Side is one of their first hits, but that kind of steps on a single by Irma Thomas.
Irma really didn't, her career was so sad. She kept getting brilliant songs, and then either they were too weird for R&B radio, or in the case of one where she really had it, which was Time Is On My Side, along comes this juggernaut from England and squashes it flat.
And they did the similar thing to the Womack brothers and the Valentinos with their song It's All Over Now. Sam Cooke had actually encouraged the Womacks to take the pill, but since they wrote the song, or at least Bobby Womack had, and take the royalty checks and shut up. But Irma didn't have that luxury. And
Irma the very good management.
Yeah. And the another band that comes out of this second wave is the Animals, who have a huge hit with House of the Rising Sun, which, you know, for as much as Eric Burdon denied it, he always claimed that he got it from the same folk sources that Bob Dylan had. It's pretty clearly obvious that the Animals got that song from Bob Dylan's first album.
Right. And Alan Price, the keyboard player, and Dylan palled around during the course of filming Don't Look Back, the movie that Dylan did on his European tour, there's an outtake from Don't Look Back that's just amazing to see, where Price and Dylan go shopping for clothing in a British menswear store or clothing. It wasn't menswear. And in the middle of their looking at the goods, this woman and her little daughter come in to buy something, and mom is just paralyzed by the sight of these two weirdos picking up shirts and trying them on. And she's trying to keep her daughter from seeing it, but the kid is like, oh, look at that. She's really fascinated. It's a wonderful thing that we haven't gotten to see until the full movie with outtakes came out on DVD. It's a wonderful thing. And so, you know, I think maybe been one of the reasons Alan Price left the Animals was that he saw what Dylan was doing, and he figured he could do the same thing himself from the piano bench.
And eventually would try. And also the big check he got for getting sole arranger's credit on The House of Rising Sun helped finance that departure. And the rest of the band to this day insists that was a group arrangement. And, you know, nobody will ever know that wasn't actually there. And before we get to the end of the chapter and Dylan's switch to folk rock, I want to hit a couple more points. We mentioned the aging rockers briefly, but one of them, Roy Orbison, who's still doing these monumental pop operas out of Nashville, has another big hit this year with Pretty Woman that supposedly he wrote on the bus with the Beatles, with Lennon and McCartney watching. And I love to think of that, this guy who's getting blown away by these young punks night after night, but he's shows him at least for a moment that the old guy still has it.
Yeah, and he also is somebody who came up in the Acuff Rose stable of writers and publishers there in Nashville. So to him, it was like a job. You know, want a song? Okay, hand me some music paper and a pen and you'll have a song. I've got my guitar here. I'll bang something out.
And the Beatles, you know, Lennon and McCartney were very much in that same mold themselves. You know, McCartney said that they used to joke, let's write a swimming pool or let's write some new cars. And and until they hear Dylan, which happens on their first trips to the U.S., they're not concerned with lyrics at all. But as soon as they get to the States, and you know, I think George Harrison was hip to Dylan a little bit before they got to the States. But as soon as they digest the Free Will of Bob Dylan, these things are percolating, just like as soon as Dylan hears the Animals doing one of his songs and getting this massive pop hit and doing it in a 4.5 minute single, which is very long for that time. I mean, most singles were 2 minutes. And so there's definitely this beginning to this cross-pollination. And, you know, you've got Mick Jagger watching James Brown, and you've got the Beatles. I don't think that the fact that the Beatles covered multiple Motown songs on their Meet the Beatles album with the Beatles in Britain, I don't think that can be underestimated for how much that helped the amazing ascent of the Supremes just a little while later. I mean, when the Beatles are doing press conference after press conference and mentioning Smokey Robinson as their favorite songwriter and Motown as their favorite records, that really gave primed white America to hear what Berry Gordy and the Supremes were putting out.
It was the sound of young America, as Gordy had always insisted.
Yeah, and he breaks through those barriers. And another guy who's, you know, a king of the scene before the Beatles come along and is watching this British explosion closely, Phil Spector, he actually flew on a plane with the Beatles before they came to America, or, you know, on their trip to America. How did Phil Spector adapt in 64?
Well, he didn't really. He was still wedded to the ethos that had given him all his success. And it was hard for him to break away. It was hard for him to envision a singer-songwriter. It was hard for him to envision a band that was static. The same five guys showed up every time they had the call. He was dependent on studio musicians. He was dependent on songwriting factories. it was something he really could not conceive of, and eventually it killed his career.
But for this last year, he's still having hits with the Righteous Brothers and others, you know, bigger than ever, and he's got his finger on the pulse. I mean, he's not only hanging with the Beatles, he's tight with the Stones manager, Andrew Lou Goldham, and actually co-writes a song with the Stones and is present when they do Buddy Holly's Not Fade Away. He and Gene Pitney supposedly saved the day by bringing some cognac and telling everybody it's Gene Pitney's birthday and let's have a drink. And that stops the fighting between Brian Jones and Mick Jagger long enough to record the song. But another producer who's been regionally successful and does adapt is UEP Moe down in Texas. What does UEP do, and where does the Sir Douglas Quintet come from?
Well, Huey wanted a Beatles, and he didn't understand. He said he didn't understand what it was about the Beatles. So he legendarily checked into a motel and rented the rooms on either side of the one he was in so they wouldn't disturb anybody, and took a portable phonograph and a bunch of Beatles records and played them over and over and over again while he drank a bottle of wine. And his revelation was, and I don't understand this technically, but it was what he said, was the beat was on the beat just like Cajun music.
And I think
his father,
go ahead.
His father, yeah, an accordion player, a Cajun accordion player.
And I think so, what he was getting at was what the Beatles called the Pete Best beat or the Mercy beat, because Pete Best, their first drummer, couldn't play anything except 1, 2, 3, 4. So it's like what we would think of as a house or disco beat, where it's the four to the floor with the bass drum going 1, 2, 3, 4, rather than the backbeat that was favored in early rock and roll. And the Beatles moved away from it, but several of their early hit singles, Please Please Me, I Want to Hold Your Hand, She Loves You, have that 1, 2, 3, 4, thump, thump, thump. And Dave Clark made his entire career off that beat. And right. So I think that's what he was honing in on. Although when you listen to She's About a Mover by the Sir Douglas Quintet, they funk it up and flip the beat, and it sounds almost like a precursor to ska.
Well, that's because, I mean, Doug was, he was playing mostly with R&B bands on the west side of San Antonio. And the famous quote from Huey, which I guess we can use since this is in broadcast media, was that Doug was pestering him, I want to make a record, I want to make a record. And Huey goes, you know, you don't have a band. All you got is songs. You know, you got to do something. And finally, after this epiphany in the motel, Doug was in Houston pestering Huey yet again. And Huey said, okay, get you a band, grow you some fucking hair, and let's make a record.
And that they did. They actually got booked on a variety TV show with Trini Lopez, who was kind of a folk pop performer who had a big hit in 63. And Trini sussed out pretty quickly that these guys were from San Antonio and not England.
Well, he found out in the dressing room. I mean, the way those guys talked, there was nowhere else they could be from. And Trini said, wait a minute, you guys aren't from England? No, man, we're from San Antonio. Oh.
Yeah, but they had a good run. She's About a Mover was a hit. And for a while, they were one of many bands Phil Spector scouted out, along with 11 Spoonful and Modern Folk Quartet and other things, as he tried to adapt to the Beatles thing. And they... You know, Bob Dylan repeatedly called them his favorite band, but they had a pot bust in 66 and the wheels came off. But I want to get to one other Texan before we get to our last segment and wrap the show. And that's Bobby Fuller, a kid from El Paso, who's definitely an acolyte of Buddy Holly, but also Phil Spector. And he's not quite on his breakthrough yet, but he's bubbling under.
Yeah, the Bobby Fuller Four had a remarkable, almost orchestral approach to playing, and they got the opportunity a lot. I mean, don't forget that when you grow up in Lubbock, as they did, and go to El Paso, the nearest recording center was Buddy Holly's old one
in Clovis, New Mexico.
Yeah, in Clovis. I was just trying to remember the name of his producer. Never mind.
I'm blanking on it, too.
Norman Petty. So that they could go, they could get in the car, drive to Norman Petty's studio and record. And if not having him produce, they'd produce themselves and save some money and just pay for the whole session, which is cheap because who went to Clovis to record? And they put out a number of records on their own label. And then they moved that label to Los Angeles. They became the house band at the Whiskey A Go-Go, which you couldn't ask for a better situation at that point. And they had great hits right up until something happened.
Yeah, until Bobby Fuller was found bruised and soaked in gasoline and supposedly with a significant amount of gasoline in his stomach, and it was ruled a suicide. But that's a pretty brutal way to kill yourself. The legend is he was messing with some L.A. mafioso's wife, but we'll probably never know.
Another theory that his brother put out in his book, which was involved the New York scene and the mafia and publishing rights.
I'm sure it was probably a money deal. And so as we wrap this episode, you end the chapter with Dylan's response to all this rock and roll that he's been hearing and that's catching his attention. And before we talk about that, I want to play an early Dylan B-side that was suppressed. And this is actually Dylan's first rock and roll record. It's called Mixed Up Confusion.
Man, and it's a killing me. There's too many people, and they're all too hard to please.
And that was Bob Dylan's Mixed Up Confusion, his first stab at rock and roll, which was in the John Hammond and Columbia quickly suppressed.
Well, it wasn't his first stab. It was his first recorded stab.
Yes, he was originally a
rock and roll band back in Minnesota, and he was conversant with the vocabulary. And, I wonder, I don't have a copy of that. And should have looked at one before I was writing about it. But I wonder whether Tom Wilson was involved with that as producer, because Wilson was the great unknown revolutionary black man from Waco who went to Boston and got involved with avant-garde jazz and then moved to New York and became a house producer at Columbia. And then after that ended, he went to Verve, where he produced the Velvet Underground and the Mothers, among others. But he also produced Bob Dylan, and he also pretty much started folk rock by taking the album that Simon and Garfunkel had just done. And while Paul Simon was in England and unable to do anything about it, overdubbing electric guitars and reissuing it as The Sounds of Silence, based on the hit that he made from those overdubbed guitars on Simon and Garfunkel's original track.
Yeah, and that was a huge hit and a culture-changing move. But Dylan beat him to the punch with his first pushed folk rock single, Subterranean Homesick Blues. Talk about the impact of that song.
Well, it was, for one thing, my first copy of that came from a college roommate who had just spent several months working at a radio station and glommed up as many singles as he could find. And the cover had clippings from the British press that said, Dylan showed us the way. And so there's the impact. And he knew that rock and roll was the way to go. I remember going to the Folklore Center, the great shrine of folk music in Greenwich Village when I was a kid, and buying a copy of Bringing It All Back Home, which was Dylan's first all or half electric album. And the girl who was behind the cash register said, you know, that's a rock and roll album. And I said, oh, his last one was too. Because I've been trying to get some kids in my high school who had a band to record something. Oh no, man, that's weird lyrics, man. Nobody will ever understand it. But I had heard that. I heard the electric band that wasn't there listening to those songs.
And so did a young Jim McGuinn and the Birds, but we'll talk about that on the next episode of Let It Roll as we continue our voyage through the history of rock and roll, Volume 2, The Beatles, The Stones, and the Rise of Classic Rock. Ed Ward, it's a pleasure to have you back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter at Let It Rollcast and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Next week, Ed Ward will be back to talk about 1966 rock and roll's second miracle year, featuring electrified Bob Dylan, the Beach Boys making Pet Sounds, Stax hitting its stride, James Brown getting funky, the Beatles dropping acid, and the beginnings of the San Francisco scene. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. The History of Rock and Roll, Volume 2, 1964 to 1977, The Beatles, The Stones, and the Rise of Classic Rock is published by Flatiron Books. Please support our show by ordering via the Amazon referral link on our website, letitrollpodcast.com.
Did you know Nissan EVs have traveled 8 billion miles? Just a quick trip to Pluto and back. And what did we learn along the way? Well, that an EV can take on the world, like the Nissan Leaf. It can move racing forward and take your breath away, like the all-new Nissan Ariya. We learned to make EVs that electrify. 8 billion miles driven by Leaf owners globally since 2010. Aria not yet available for purchase. Expected availability late fall. Subject to change.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.